It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly. Now, when do the pollsters get it wrong? How badly do they get it wrong? Can we trust polling today as a result? A cracking chat coming up with Mark Pack. He's the president of the Lib Dems, but don't hold that against him. He's also a polling, I think nerd is probably the right word. And he's written a brand new book called Polling Unpacked. And he's going to take us through when pollsters have got things wrong and how they are getting things better. So that's coming up on the podcast in just a moment. But first, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. And on a Thursday, it's Night at the Marriott. It's India Knight and James Marriott. James, let's talk about your column first of all. It's basically, what is it, 1,000 words, your column today?
Yes.
It's 1,000 words of you just explaining why you haven't come into the studio today.
That was exactly it. I was planning well in advance. I was getting my excuses in early.
So
I know how harshly you were judged on the Matt Jolly show.
So where are you now? Judging by your column, you're either lying it on the floor at the end of your bed or walking along the Regent's Canal.
I'm actually standing on my bed.
Are you?
Yeah. I find it a useful place to talk.
So explain why you're standing on your bed, or at least give us the outline of your column today.
Well, I was just thinking, one of the kind of weird things about a weekly column is that you have to have at least one thought per week, which is, I think, a kind of annoyingly high number of thoughts to have to summon. So you kind of become obsessed with how to think. And I don't know, I think sort of the latter 6 months of doing this column has been me increasingly wondering how on earth do I make thoughts occur to me? Where can I find thoughts? What can I do to have thoughts? And basically concluding that a lot of modern life and modern working practices seem like they could have almost been specifically designed to stop you having thoughts. So I've been sort of trying to work out how I can avoid that and where I can go to think, basically.
And so that's why the place for you to think is on the floor between 8 o'clock and midnight.
Yes, I've always discovered that. Ever since I was a child, I've loved to lie on the floor and think. I don't know why thoughts come there. I don't think it's that eccentric. I think it's a perfectly, it's very, very close to, it's very, very, it's maybe, you know, slightly further, slightly lower than a bed or a chair. I don't think it's eccentric. I just think it's you try it.
India, where are you speaking to us from right now?
I am speaking to you as ever from my kitchen table.
I'm
sitting on a chair at the kitchen table.
Which, while you're speaking, I'll lie on the floor and I'll see if. Go on, India. Take it away, India. What do you think about James's theory on thinking?
Well, I think it is strange being a columnist because you do have to come up with one halfway decent idea by the day before your column appears. And I get my thoughts either sitting in this very chair at this very kitchen table or in shops talking to people. talking to people in shops, I find it really useful. I find people in shops are like sort of mini ready-made focus groups if they're chatty. And so if you start sort of talking to people in the queue at the Co-op, you get quite a good impression of what people are thinking about and what's on their minds, and often that can be quite inspiring. But I very much admire James's dedication to the process, because I remain kind of upright and out and about by and large when I'm trying to have a thought. I admire the dedication, you know, the supineness and the peace and the quiet and the way, which is probably why his thoughts are rather superior to mine. but yeah, it's a good technique.
I could definitely get on board with this, doing the show on the floor. I'm aware it doesn't sound.
Yeah, but you sound quite distant, yeah, Matt. You sound
fine. I'll get back up.
I think the quality perceptibly improved during that last minute on the floor.
James, why are you standing on the bed?
I was sort of bouncing myself into a kind of conversational rhythm. I don't know. Do you ever do that? I don't know.
If I stand on the bed, I'd want to bounce, and then the quality of the sound would be impaired.
Yes, but I was sort of just gently sort of rocking myself, I suppose.
But your point, James, which I thought was interesting, was now like half of the population go to university. We're training up, you know, people who think big thoughts about things, and then we enter the world of work and put them in rows of desks with lots of clattering noise and emails and everything else, which is the least conducive way to thinking. And I thought what was really interesting was the thing you'd also picked out is that technology has meant that people who were big thinkers, maybe they were managers or, you know, they were the creatives or whatever, technology now means that instead of having someone else to, you know, having a secretary who does your expenses, you have to do your own on your phone. Or, you know, you have to make your own presentation. So actually, the higher up you go in an organisation, you don't even get any more time to think and come up with smart, creative ideas, because you're sort of doing all the admin of office life.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's been a real change. I think there was a time when, if you're working in an office, you could be... I mean, I don't think it's good to be left totally alone, but if you needed long periods of, like, being by yourself to just properly think things through, you could just go to your office and do that. But now, you know, these kind of extra tasks that would once have been done by support staff, kind of, they just intrude everywhere. My other big thing that I'm really big on is I think if you want to think properly, you do have to move. I think, you know, walking up and down, as you're going through all these sort of, you know, various philosophers and scientists in history, and they've almost all of them have gone walking. Einstein used to like sailing, although apparently he often crashed, which isn't very conducive to thinking. But presumably up until the moment he was crashing, he was doing fantastic things with relativity. I think a bit of time by yourself, move around, being stuck in a noisy office, I think is no good. And actually, I've read loads of really good stuff about open plan offices, and open plan offices basically seem to have no advantages. And it's been shown that employees working in open plan offices not only distracted by each other more, but they actually talk to each other less, because nobody knows how to interrupt, because everyone kind of could be working. Whereas if you're in your own separate office, people will go and interrupt each other and knock on each other's doors more, apparently.
That's interesting. Is this all just India? Is this just proof of how actually the working from home culture, it might be good if it's stuck a bit, maybe not full time?
I think so, absolutely. I think people need to be able to be a bit free range in order to be creative. I was just remembering many, 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 many years ago, I was a feature writer at the Mail on Sunday, and we had a features editor who, if any of us were looking uninspired, would either give us 50 quid, I mean, for a group of people, to go to the pub and have some and come back with ideas, or or if you were sort of staring into space blankly, he'd say, oh, you need to go for a walk. And so you'd go for a walk down Kensington High Street, and you would, you know, both from the pub and from the walk, you would come back with a fairly decent bunch of ideas, which I don't think would have been generated just sitting at your desk.
Well, that's all.
But that was in the old days.
That was in the good old days. Yeah. And actually, if you see, I mean, what was interesting yesterday, we were speaking to Abigail from Cambridge Alive. And as a result of the pandemic, you know, Reach, the local newspaper group, have got rid of basically almost all their offices. And you say, well, that's terrible. But actually what it has meant is journalists have just go out and about, just to get out of the house. They go out and about more. They chat to people. They knock on doors. They literally see what's going on. And they pick up some more stories as a result. I mean, they're probably going to pick up more stories there than James bouncing on his bed. But then he hasn't got to do any work now for another week.
It's the quality of thoughts that he gets from bouncing on the bed. I'm all for it.
Maybe that's what we should. Can we get a bed in here? Get rid of we'll get rid of Mariella's sex chair and we'll get a little trampoline in. let's move on, because I think that's quite enough of everyone picturing James in his Thomas the Tank pajamas still. let's talk about calories on menus. From today, restaurants, cafes and takeaways with more than 250 staff must print how many calories are in meals on their menus, websites and delivery platforms. Just to try and take the fun out of life even more, India.
Yeah, exactly. Just to make everything a kind of guilt-tripping, miserable, anxiety-inducing experience. I think it's a really sort of silly and pointless thing. Also, I don't really believe in calories. I mean, I know a calorie is a calorie, but actually a calorie isn't a calorie because obviously the calorie you get from a can of Coke is not the same nutritionally as the calorie you get from spinach. So, you know, it's possible, for example, to be on a diet and eat very, very few calories and lose weight. But the stuff that you're putting into your body is terrible for it. And, you know, plays havoc with your insulin levels and makes you have sugar highs and sugar lows and that kind of very typical crash at 4 PM when you think, if I don't have a Mars bar, I'm going to pass out. So I think they're silly from that point of view. But also, I mean, your point is the main one. You know, how is it fun to go to a restaurant, look at the menu, go, I really fancy that, and then, oh, but it's 5 million calories and it's, you know, it's therefore likely to make me fat. It's just joy sapping. It takes all the fun out of everything, out of eating, certainly.
What about you, James? I mean, we know you like to eat pasta in the bath, but if you were going to eat out...
I know. Well, I understand why we think it's joyless, and I especially understand why people think, you know, it's bad for people with eating disorders, and that's really not helpful. I personally, from a personal point of view, I'm looking forward to it. I really want to eat more healthily, and I've been kind of shocking myself into it this morning, looking at all these like Pizza Hut pizzas that literally have like more than a grown man's like daily calorific allowance and like one.
But James, did you not know that before?
Yeah, what did you think? Well, what did you think when you went to Pizza Hut and you got one of those? When you order the pizza, and it's got that sort of sheen of oil across the top of it. What did you
kind of know it? You kind of know it, but you also kind of don't know it. But it's kind of, I don't know. It's just kind of now you really can't avoid it. And then, I mean, I have seen some silly stuff. I saw people posting on Twitter their offices posting how many calories were in like a cup of tea. So like English breakfast tea, 0.84 calories. So I think it's going to be more English breakfast teas and less pizzas for me.
But now you know that the shock news that Pizza Hut pizzas might be high in calories. Does that mean you're going to go to Pizza Hut and just have the salad wagon? Or will you just feel guilty as you munch away through a Hawaiian? I mean, it doesn't make it giving you this information. Is having this information going to make you change your eating behavior? That's the point. Because there's no point otherwise just making you depressed while you eat the same food.
I think I'm going to do better. My other horrifying discovery recently was that I've become obsessed with a salad from Pret a Manger that looked really healthy, and then it turned out to be like had like more calories in it when I Googled it than like a Big Mac or something. I mean, it was just preposterous, and I was like, well, you can never tell. You know, you don't know where they're lurking. And it's just, I don't know. I think it's going to be good for me. Maybe not for everyone else, but I'm looking forward to it.
Very good, very good. Right, then finally, let's talk about pop culture. There's a new British pop archive is being developed. What do you make of this, India?
I really like the look of this. It's in Manchester and it's being curated by... the 1980s music journalist John Savage. I think it's John Savage.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Savage. And it celebrates the significant and long lasting achievements of pop culture. I don't know because I'm too old now, but I feel very lucky to have been a teenager and young person in the 80s and early 90s. Well, late 70s to late 80s, actually, where it just, you know, British pop culture was just the coolest thing in the entire world. And I know there were reboots of the coolness, but I feel that particular period was really kind of had been unequaled since the 1960s. And the idea of taking it seriously and of cataloguing it and remembering it and honouring it seems a very cheerful thing to me. I'm very glad they're doing it. And I like the juxtaposition, the high-low juxtaposition, you know, of this being in the same museum as the first folio of some Shakespeare something.
Yeah, having like Coronation Street and Prime Suspect alongside, you know, and a pair of Hacienda trainers and something from Shakespeare.
These are things, but these they really matter to people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. They really, really matter to people. They're part of the fabric of who everybody is in one way or another. And I don't like the idea of thinking that, you know, these things are ephemeral or disposable. They're really, really kind of hefty and significant. So it's good to see them being given their heft, their space to be hefty in.
India Knight and James Marriott then. And of course, you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's Polling Unpacked.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this. When it all goes wrong.
Probably the liveliest piece of news that's ever been used to introduce the president of the Liberal Democrats for a in-depth discussion about the merits of political polling. But Mark Pack is here. Hello, Mark.
Lovely to join you, Matt.
It's nice to have you here. And we're talking about polling. You've got a new book, Polling Unpacked, tracing the origins of polling and asking how reliable polls really are. So in a moment, you're going to walk us through five polling disasters over the years. Yeah. And what we can learn from them. But let's go, first of all, right back to the beginning. Because now polling is such a built-in part of what happens in politics. How did it begin? I genuinely don't know the answer.
Most likely started in the early 19th century when there was a particularly lively US presidential election, 1826. And naturally, just like we all these days, people wanted to know, well, who might be winning, who might be ahead, who might be more popular. And so the habit of straw polls started off of, say, at a military muster meeting, asking everyone who turned up to serve in the militia, who are you going to vote for in the presidential election? And so from those sort of slightly amateurish early days through to, you know, the latest scientific methods, the sort of methodology has got more and more sophisticated, but the basic purpose and the basic idea is still the same. Get a typical group of people together, ask them who they support, and then hopefully you get the right answer.
And let's get in the weeds quickly, because that's what we're here for. Because when you say typical group of people, how do you make sure you do that? And let's talk weighting.
Yeah, so it's really hard to get a properly representative group of people to take part in a poll, because not everyone is happy to take part in polls. Not everyone trusts pollsters. Some people are really busy. So what pollsters do is they try quite hard to get a typical group. They know they fail to get a typical group, and then they weight their answers to try and make that group more typical. So maybe you've done a poll and you don't have enough teenagers. Teenage men are particularly hard to get hold of to do polls with. So you take the teenage men that you do have in the poll and you give their answers more weight to try and make the answers representative overall. And most of the time that works really well, but occasionally you can get caught out when there's a factor that suddenly becomes important in politics and you didn't realise, oh, we needed to make our sample representative of that group of people.
Which I suspect will be some of the things that are coming up in just a moment. And what's the right number of people for a poll?
It matters a lot less than most people think. But basically, if you want to know what the national level of support is, say, for parties in the UK or indeed in any country, 1,000 upwards is fine. If you're looking at, say, an individual constituency, 500 upwards is fine. But almost always when the polls go wrong, it's not because they didn't ask enough people. It's because they asked the wrong people or did the wrong things with the answers or people misunderstood the answers. So generally, sample size gets people excited, but it doesn't matter that much.
And without swearing on the radio, what do you think of Twitter polls? is the correct answer. Right, here we go. So we're going to count down five big polling disasters in history. We're going to start with the 1936 presidential election.
We are fighting to save a great and precious form of government for ourselves and for the world. And so I accept the commission you have tendered me. I join with you.
That was, that sounded like a gun going off at the end. That was Franklin D. Roosevelt giving a speech ahead of the 1936 US election. He went on to win a massive landslide, the biggest landslide since the 1850s, but the polling was wrong.
Yeah, that's right. So the Literary Digest was the premier pollster of the time, and they did what to us to now seems a really crude thing of basically getting their readers to tell them who they were going to vote for. But it had worked for several...
Bit Daily Express website, that, isn't it?
But it had worked for several presidential elections in a row, and they made a real virtue of how they had millions of people responding to their poll, their survey. They'd got it right several times in a row. But in 36, they predicted a Republican landslide. As you say, it was actually a Democrat landslide. And three, what we would now call modern scientific pollsters, had their debut in the 36 election, and they all got it right. George Gallup was the best self-publicist, so he's the one that people have normally heard of, but Roper and Crosley also debuted their polls at that election, also got it right. Ironically, Gallup's polls weren't actually that accurate. He got Roosevelt, the Democrat support, wrong by 7 percentage points, which most of the time you'd say is a bit of a polling disaster, but what he predicted was a landslide. Roosevelt actually got even more of a landslide. And so, of course, nobody really minded about that error. It was the fact that they'd got the winner right and the Literary Digest had got it wrong.
And that's such an important thing, is that when people say, oh, the pollsters got it wrong, actually, if they get it wrong but call the outcome right, nobody remembers.
Exactly.
So the polls, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to it, but, you know, in general elections and referendums that happened since, you know, the margin of error could only be 2 or 3 points. And it's very close. They could be very, very close. But if they were 2 points the other way,
absolutely,
they'd have called it right.
Yeah. And 1997 was a great example of that, that people don't think of 97 as being a bad election for the polls in the UK, but they predicted a big Labour win. Labour did get a big win, but it was actually quite a lot different from what a lot of the polls were saying. So had that been a close election, it would have been, oh, the polls were awful, because, you know, it was not quite as big a landslide as the polls were saying, still a landslide. In a sense, who cares?
Yeah. Interestingly, in 1936, we were talking about, you know, how many people do you need? They sent out 10 million questionnaires to their readers, and 2.27 million replied.
Exactly. You can see why, if you don't know how polling works, that sounds... Look, you've got answers from nearly 3 million people. Of course your answer's going to be right. So it was a real shock. And I think probably privately, a huge amount of relief, maybe not a shock to George Gallup, but a huge amount of relief to him and the other pollsters that their newer methodology, talking to a tiny fraction of that number of people, got it right.
But what Literary Digest could have done is taken that 2.27 million people, asked them, when they were doing their questionnaire, how old are you, where do you live, what do you do, what's your income, and then done a bit of waiting. I mean, waiting all 2 million would have probably taken quite a long time in those days.
Yeah, no computers to
but,
do it.
But if they were basically coming back and they're all 65-year-old men who live in Texas, then
they should have
they
known,
might
yeah.
have thought, oh, hang on, this might not be representative of teenagers in California.
Yeah, they had two problems. One was their sampling was basically too Republican, but that was only about a third of the problem. The other two-thirds was a differential response rate, so that people who were more likely to vote Democrat were less likely to respond to their survey. And that's the sort of differential response rate problem that's really hard to deal with waiting, because you might have the right number of men, the right number of Texans, the right number of pensioners, but if you've got Republicans keener to respond than Democrats, you may well still not get your weighting right.
And so in the same way that I joked about the Daily Express, the Times website runs polls, all that tells you is, what did Times readers at that moment think?
Yeah, and that can be interesting.
It's interesting.
You know, if Times readers were to overwhelmingly say that, for example, they think Britain should have nothing whatsoever to do with helping the Ukrainian government, that wouldn't be a scientific poll, but that would be quite a surprising result. That would be worth checking. Well, did the Russian bots get at the poll? Or...
Yeah. It would tell you something. It just wouldn't tell you what the country was thinking. Right, let's fast forward a bit now. We are coming back to the UK, 1970. Ted Heath for the Conservatives, Harold Wilson for Labour, and Heath was not expected to win.
I think that this is very important, and everybody here would certainly agree, that we've been passing through a period of disillusionment with government. And this is particularly true of the young. The reason for it, of course, is that so many promises were given by the Labour Party and then broken.
As Ted Heath there whipping the nation into a frenzy. Mark Pack, this was sort of the UK's first big polling disaster.
Yeah, the polls in Britain had started in 1945, and they'd, unlike pundits, had got the 45 election right. So they'd had a good run. They seemed to be a good source of information. But ahead of the 1970 election, overall, the picture was suggesting Labour would get, Harold Wilson would get re-elected. Turned out to be a Tory victory. And so it was the Waterloo of the polls, as David Butler christened it. It was a bit of a disaster. And it was a particular disaster because it was the first election at which newspapers who commissioned polls had relaxed the copyright on the polls. So newspapers were able to report each other's polls as well. And, for example, a third of the Times front pages during the election featured polls. So polls were the really big thing in that election. And then they got it horribly wrong. And it's hard to give a simple answer. In fact, if you read my book, you'll probably have even less of an idea as to why the polls got it wrong in 70.
So because, that's a ringing endorsement.
Well, because one of the common theories I sort of have a go at demolishing, that it wasn't just a matter of there was a late swing. That, you know, if you look at the exact dates when polls were done, that story doesn't stand up. But I think what 1970 illustrates is that when the polls go wrong, it's often a lot of different small factors, which most of the time you get one thing a bit wrong one way and it counterbalanced by something being a bit wrong the other way. In 1970, really unluckily for the pollsters and the public, those errors all ended up lining up in one direction. So they all pushed the polls way off. And it's a bit like, you know, if you go to your doctor for a really thorough health checkup, you know, the doctor will inspect you and find all sorts of things that might be a bit wrong, that might cause a problem. And you never can be quite sure which is the exact precise one that's causing the ailment. But, you know, it's a good idea to try and deal with all of the problems. And so the reaction of the polling industry to that 70 disaster was to make quite a few changes to try and improve their methodology. And they did have then a good run in subsequent elections. But it is still a bit of a mystery. And I think the key lesson, and therefore, is it's very rarely the case there's just one simple explanation that's the be-all and end-all. And so be suspicious of pundits touting just one polling story.
And I suppose, actually, you're trying to use science on human beings and herding them into, you know, quite often, you know, I remember looking into the details of polls before where, you know, Lib Dems who voted Leave, UKippers who voted Remain, you know, these are human beings. Some of them are a bit hard to predict. They don't all do the thing that you always expect. So it's a...
They say there's a huge amount of wonderful variation. I mean, as you say, the UKIP Lib Dem swing voters are a real group of people that exist. Yeah. But I think to anyone interested in politics, it's completely baffling that there can be a UKIP Lib Dem swing voter.
Because actually, they're probably people who aren't that interested in politics. But yeah, I mean, to go from... So the polls back then predicting Labour up to 12 points ahead of the Tories. And then the Tories won... with a lead of 3.5%. The Times journalist George Clark wrote the election would be remembered as the occasion when the people of the United Kingdom hurled the findings of the opinion polls back in the faces of the pollsters. Something that I think we might discuss, some of the things happening coming up. Right, we move on now. This is the third polling disaster with Mark Pack. We reach 1992. Neil Kinnock was expected to win comfortably against John Major.
I think people in this country want to be convinced. They want to know what someone stands for, what their policies are, what they would mean, and how they would carry them out.
Another great Tory leader there, whipping us up into a frenzy. Once again, Neil Kinnock was on course to win in 1992. Was it the pollsters? Did the campaign make a difference? What went wrong this time?
Yeah, I mean, this was really dramatic because it looked like it would be a bit close, but the Labour probably would win, and so people were... You know, sort of on the edge of their seats, and then the exit poll pointed towards, probably a Labour victory. And then the first few results started coming in, and then, oh, crikey, maybe it's not going to be a Labour victory. And then the famous victory for the sadly now late David Amos in Basildon, and his huge grinning face on being announced, having successfully held the seat for the Tories, was really the visual image of the polls getting it wrong. Polls had said he should lose, and there was he hugely grinning and happy having won. And it was really probably a mix of three things. One was there was some late swing away from Labour in the election. There was some faulty sampling, partly because 92 was... Pollster still had to work with the 1981 census, because the 1991 census data wasn't yet available. So they're waiting how many, you know, what proportion of different groups in the population should you wait to? They didn't have up-to-date information. They got some of that wrong. And then also there was, and this is a bit more controversial, but it certainly seems that for some pollsters, there was a problem with what was called the shy Tory effect, that some Tories were just less keen on taking part in polls, a bit more embarrassed about maybe admitting they were Tory, because it was a rather unfashionable thing to be Tory in 1992, at least until the election result came in. So again, mix of different things. And all of them meant that afterwards, a lot of people felt, well, just the polls have given us the wrong story about the election. But in fairness to the pollsters, there are a lot of elections between 1970 and 92 when they had got it right.
Mark, we reached 2016, not a good year for pollsters.
No.
Well, as we're doing it in chronological order, let's start with one of the big early disasters for polling in 2016.
This is, should be a British passport. It says European Union on it, all right? I think to make this country safer, we need to get back British passports.
Oh, such a big issue, that. Of course, the Brexit referendum in 2016, of the 168 polls carried out ahead of the EU referendum, only a third predicted a Leave vote. What went wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the polls weren't that badly off this time around. If you look at their final figures, they had Remain on 52%, Leave on 48%, and it was the other way around. So a couple of 4 points out each way, which is not a massive error. It's the sort of error you should expect on average one time in six. But, you know, we all, and I include myself in that, I think, looked at the polls and most people took a much heavier chance of a Remain victory than in hindsight we should have. And what seems to have been a problem there was particularly that there are people less interested in politics, less likely to vote usually in elections, less likely to respond to polls. Actually, there's a good chunk of them were quite energised by the referendum campaign and decided to come out and vote. And therefore, that was enough to tip polls from being fairly close to just being that bit sufficiently off that they'd got the winner wrong in what was a close race. But one of the lessons I think to take from it is, you know, if you've got looking at something like a 52-48 percentage figures, that's a 1 in 6 chance it's going to be the other way around. That might sound quite low, but if you had a revolver, 5 empty chambers, 1 bullet in it, you'd be thinking, 1 in 6 could happen. 1 in 6 could happen.
And actually, trajectory is important as well. Mm. That actually, during the course of the campaign, Remain sort of started that year ahead, and it got narrower as we got closer. So you sort of think, well, if the vote had been a couple of weeks later, the pollsters would have probably, you know, if the trajectory continued, they might have picked it up.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, you mentioned the polls overall, but if you look just at the ones in June, they were almost exactly 50-50 split. It was 14 had Remain in the lead, 16 had Leave in the lead, 1 had it tied, and 1 had 2 different methodologies, and you could pick either Remain or Leave in the lead. So, you know, it was almost exactly split, the polls, in the last couple of weeks.
Do you think, given that the majority of politicians in Westminster were reporting Remain, supporting Remain, in terms of sort of the what we'd probably call the out-of-touch metropolitan elite chattering classes who sit in glass buildings like this in London, Remain was the overwhelming feature, was there sort of optimism bias or just wanting to believe the polls that showed Remain were going to win, therefore disbelieving the others?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a bit of wanting one particular result and therefore people focusing on things like how often in referendums you see a swing towards the status quo at the last moment. So there was a lot of talk about the academic research that shows that and very little talk about the 1 in 6 chance that you should expect based on those figures the result will go the other way. And I think that reflects when people want a particular outcome, you tend to look for things that make that outcome more likely rather than tend to look for things that make it less likely. And so, as you say, because the media and Westminster bubble overall was so heavily Remain, that almost certainly did skew things.
And given, because there were so many polls, over 168, what impact then does polling have on the campaign? Because clearly campaigning could shift the polls, but then polls, if it looks like the polls are narrowing, that can then have an impact on people thinking, well, what I thought was a thing which was never going to happen, actually maybe it might happen, and so that might then influence how you're going to vote.
I mean, in that sense, I guess the pollsters have a fairly good alibi with the Brexit referendum, because the story they told was that, oh, it's looking close, but Remain will probably win. But there was clearly, it was looking close-ish. And that almost certainly helped produce the very high turnout in the referendum. So in that sense, the pollsters may have made the outcome a surprise for us, but at least they mobilised people knowing correctly that it's going to be a close thing. I think much more problematic is things like the 2015 election, where the polls pointed towards a hung parliament and then it wasn't a hung parliament. And then in hindsight, you say, well, maybe that election would have been reported a bit differently if we'd had more accurate polls in it. But at least in the referendum, the basic story of it's close was true.
Because actually the debate around 2015 was, you know, Ed Miliband's going to win or it's going to be a hung parliament. There was very little scrutiny of what does a Conservative majority government look like, including the promise of an EU referendum.
Indeed, the
demise of the Lib Dems from the coalition. Let's move on then to the to our final polling disaster. This is another one from 2016.
And I don't know, the polls now, a poll just came out where essentially we're even, and I'm feeling it. You know, when I went to New Hampshire, I wasn't supposed to win, right?
Yes, Donald Trump winning the 2016 US presidential election. Was it a polling disaster?
Sort of. But in fairness to the pollsters, the national polls in the US in 2016 pretty much got it right. You look at the average just before polling day in the US, the Real Clear Politics average had it as Clinton 47, Trump 44. The actual result was Clinton 48, Trump 46. Pretty much dead on. But two big mistakes. One was lots of people assumed that if you're ahead in the vote, you'll therefore win the Electoral College. And actually, that isn't what happened. Easy mistake to make, because although everyone sort of technically knew that wasn't the case, the previous time it happened in 2000, which was this really weird election with Florida and the hanging chads and all of that, and the last time before that had been 1888. So there was just this assumption, oh, if Clinton's ahead in the poll, surely she's going to win. So that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was there were some state polls that were really badly off, particularly in a trio of northern US states that Trump won by unbelievably small margins. Had he not won them, he would have lost. The polls had Clinton doing well in them, partly because of late swing, partly because of undersampling, people with lower levels of formal education. Those state polls were quite badly wrong, and therefore, you know, the national picture polls were right, but because the state polls being wrong, people had drawn the wrong conclusion, thinking Clinton was pretty much, you know, very, very likely to win. There were all sorts of projections giving her 98%, you know, supposed certainty of winning, which you probably never should give that high a certainty on anything in life. But so in a way, the polls, the national polls were right. Some state polls were badly wrong. And the analysis all levered on top of it was quite misleading.
Again, the media class could not believe that Donald Trump would actually win. So that ends up influencing.
Yeah, I mean, had, say, it been Mitt Romney as the Republican candidate and he'd been the shock winner, I think it would have been much less of a shock, because the fact that it was Trump, such an exceptional, out of the ordinary candidate winning, that made it a real shock.
And we've talked about how after each shock, the pollsters changed what they do. I mean, they were slightly better when it came to the 2019 general election. You know, they predicted the Tories were going to win, you know, comfortably, and they did. How much can we trust what the polls are telling us right now, then?
I think quite a lot, not 100% for the reasons we've just been running through these five failures. But across, you know, we've been talking about elections across near on 100 years. Across two countries, there have been huge numbers of elections and referendums and other votes that we've not talked about, in all of which the polls were pretty good. Yeah, we've just highlighted the high-profile failures. And so, overall, pollsters are much better than political pundits at getting it right. Apologies to political pundits who are listening in, but I'm afraid that, you know, that you look at the research into the record of pundits, go for a pollster over a pundit any day. But, you know, don't take it as absolute certainty. There will be, you know, maybe it's one time in five, one time in six, where the polls will end up misleading you. But better to be well informed the rest of the time from them. So pay attention to them, but don't stake your life on them.
And just forget, wait, now you're such an expert in polling. You've written a whole book about polling. Why are the Liberal Democrats, of which you're president of, not doing better in the polls? You should be able to game them. You should know how to do this.
Yeah, well, if you read some of the footnotes carefully, you'll see me recanting some of my belief on a previous internal polling that the Lib Dems have done. But I think fundamentally, you know, the big challenge for smaller parties, including the Lib Dems, is one of grabbing public attention. And so there is often quite a gap between the potential of what a party can do and what it can then pull off when there's an actual election on, and you see, like we saw in the by-elections last year and so on, versus what people are thinking when they're asked by a pollster, when they're not really thinking about politics. They don't really think much about politics at all, let alone thinking about the Lib Dems. But give them a few weeks of Lib Dem leaflets coming through their letterbox every other day, as we saw in North Shropshire, you can get a very, very different outcome.
So would you expect a massive change in the Lib Dems' prospects ahead of the next general election?
I think you look at a lot of those blue wall parliamentary constituencies, there's really good prospects for there to be a very significant increase in the number of Lib Dem MPs at the next election. But a lot of that is going to be down to that local campaigning to buck the national picture, to make people give people a reason to think about the Lib Dems in their seat in a way that it's, you know, obviously Times Radio is wonderfully generous in its coverage to the Lib Dems, but it's always a bit of a struggle to get national media coverage for a smaller party.
Just funny, you've got a copy of your book. Mm. You mentioned that I'm in it. I've not seen a copy
yeah,
of your book.
Yeah, you feature in a footnote. You feature in a footnote.
In a good way or a bad way?
In a neutral way. I just use the example of that when people cover polls, they often slip from talking about the past tense to the current tense. So a poll might tell you Labour's gone up 4 points.
Yeah.
But it's really common for journalists to then rewrite that as the polls showing Labour is going up, as if that's something that's still happening.
So you picked up something that
I've... And I used one example from the Redbox early morning email of the past tense.
Well, it was five.
Versus current tense. But yeah, but, I mean, it was written at 5 a.m. in the morning, yeah, probably, I mean,
let me off, your alibi. Let me off. Mark, it's lovely to see you. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a really good reminder that, you know, yes, we should listen to polls and, you know, follow them, but also, you know, a pinch of salt is always advisable.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the Redbox Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. And you can listen via the Times Radio app. Catch me Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, live on Times Radio. And if you want to come on and play the hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? Email me your details, matt.chorley@times.radio. And we'll get you on very soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.